You're listening to Start Writing, where we explore the great minds behind the greatest stories. Hosted by Joseph Bendosky, author of the Skyfall series, and Jay Washburn, author of the Star Child space opera. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Start Writing Podcast. I am very excited about our guest today. His name is Bill Gifford. He is the co-author of New York Times bestseller Outlive, The Science and Art of Longevity. It is currently the number one on the New York Times nonfiction list, and it has held this position for 15 weeks and counting. Now, we tend to focus on fiction in this podcast, so why are we talking to a nonfiction author? I had him on as a guest for a few important reasons. First of all, I believe he has some important things to teach us about taking nonfiction, like a list of facts, and adding character arcs and narrative drama. And he did this beautifully in Outlive, and I truly believe that is why it is a bestseller. We also can learn a lot from him about being a co-author, and you'll hear me ask him some questions along those lines. And then finally, I just wanted to put in a personal plug, a personal reason that I wanted to interview him. So I keep lists of all kinds of stuff. It's kind of an OCD thing that I do. One of these lists is my top 10 books, top 10 favorite book, which is essentially an impossible list to create. It's just too short. But because I needed to have some more space on that list, I separated it out. So I have top 10 fiction and top 10 nonfiction. And for years, I've had one of those 10 slots is for a health book in nonfiction. And for a long time, that's been Michael Pollan. You know, he's got various food books, and I just feel like nutrition is a big part of being healthy. But Outlive just came out, you know, a couple months ago, and it displaced the former health champion. And this is now my top health book of all time. I think everyone ought to read it. And it covers the gamut from nutrition to exercise and sleep and even mental health. And I just think it is an essential read for everyone. It really is that good. If you're only going to read one book on health, this is it. So I'll leave it at that. And now please enjoy my interview with best-selling author Bill Gifford. So tell me, how's your day going? What's your morning been like?
Just your basic suburban Salt Lake City morning. did some work in the yard while it was, you know, out on some computer work out in the patio while it was still cool. Mm-hmm. The gutter people came, took my kid on a hot bike ride for about an hour. Mm-hmm. And, now we're doing this.
Dang. That's so cool. Seems like a good day.
Yeah. So far. Yeah.
So I have two main questions I want to ask you about writing, but before we do that, I want to kind of have you introduce yourself. And one thing, I was reading your bio on Amazon a couple of days ago. You said the Washington City paper paid you in beer, rice, and beans. And then you said when you worked at Men's Journal, your job title was editor at large, which is the world's best job title.
Indeed.
And then your book Spring Chicken, the subtitle is Stay Young Forever or Die Trying. And, you know, obviously I'm noticing a theme here. These are kind of funny. Tell me about the role that humor plays in your life and then also in your writing.
Okay. Well, so if you were my therapist, I would say, well, you know, when I was a kid, my parents decided that I should skip a grade. And so, because I was bored in school, right? And so what that meant was that for my entire life, I was like the smallest kid in the class for a lot of it. So I had to I had to sort of talk my way out of situations. And I found that, if you can make people laugh, one way or another, like that helped a lot. So, yeah, and I like humor. I did my college thesis on medieval comedy.
Oh,
I love
really?
humor. And yeah,
So
yeah.
does that mean like Chaucer, Shakespeare? What
Yeah,
kind of
Chaucer.
tale?
Chaucer.
Okay.
Yeah, the dirty
Wow, really?
stories. Yeah,
Yeah.
yeah.
Dang, that's super cool. I just remember thinking that, like, reading a Shakespeare play and realizing how funny it was and just
Oh
being
my God.
shocked that
Yeah.
it could last, that humor could last like that. That's
Yeah.
cool.
Yeah. It's like universal and, and like slapstick humor obviously is like always funny. And he did some of that, and Chaucer did a lot of that. And situational, like your parents' jokes probably aren't that funny, but Chaucer's jokes are funny,
Tell me, how old were you, or when and how did you know that you wanted to be a writer?
So again, getting back on the therapist couch, like my dad was not like your typical American, like, throw the old football around, let's go toss a baseball, son, kind of guy. Like, so he took me to the library every Saturday, and I loved reading. And the children's librarians liked me, and they were always giving me books. I was coming home with stacks of books, and then I started getting topical. So I'd do like these big research projects as like a 7-year-old into like dinosaurs or rocks, and I do a whole big like a mural basically, but basically like a magazine spread on a huge piece of construction paper with pictures and writing, and I write little essays about the different dinosaurs. And yeah,
That's
so
like your hobby.
that's kind of what started it. And then in school I was pretty good at like math and hard sciences, but then I thought I wanted to do that when I got to college, but I kind of hit the wall in terms of my mathematical abilities, and also those subjects were not taught particularly well at my college. And so then I just flipped back into ended up as an English major, but I just loved writing, and I all kinds of writing. And I kind of came out of college, I discovered nonfiction writing as a college student, and I just kind of came out of school just fired up to be a journalist.
Dang, that's cool. And you've done a ton of journalism. You've written, I guess, is this your third
Too
book
much.
or how many books?
So yeah, third book. And Spring Chicken was the predecessor and the prequel, I guess. So it was also about longevity, but it was more of a like personal investigation of the science of aging from a lay person's point of view. So, I had turned 40 or 40 something, so I was like, what the heck is happening to me? Let's see what science has to say. And then Outlive, the current book, I wrote it with Dr. Peter Attia, so it's much more of a sort of medical perspective. And he's sort of asking, how can I change what I do or the way I do medicine in a way that helps my patients stay healthier rather than just trying to fix them when they're sick? And then the first book was completely different. It was a biography of a 18th century sort of traveler, adventurer, writer, and sort of bon vivant, named John Ledyard. And that was really fun, but not a lot of people bought it. I still love it. I think it's a fun read.
Yeah, I think it's
Adventure,
a
it's kind
very
of
fun
up
read.
your alley a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. Dang, well, that's so cool. Let's see. Well, so I wanted to ask you about your writing voice. You have a very unique writing voice, and again, the humor is
I
part
do.
of it. Well, I just want to ask you, is it, do you feel like that's something just innate and natural, or have you really tried to develop that voice? Like, how does a writer get such a cool voice like you have as a writer?
Well, I think you find your voice, and I'm kind of it's a little bit how you talk, but it's better, you know, and you just, mine was kind of shaped by magazine writing, especially where you really have to, and, you know, long form all weekly journalism also to some extent, but you really have to like engage the reader, like from the first paragraph, and you have to like kind of surprise them and you, and then you have to keep their interest. And, you know, I think earlier in my career, I did some pieces that were like a little bit more lecture-y and not voicey enough. So you have to talk to them like you're a friend almost, like you're like the funny uncle, which I am. I'm the funny uncle to my nieces.
That's so funny that you say that, because that's exactly what I thought when I started reading Spanish Chicken. I was like, this is like my Uncle Dave. This is so funny. And I just loved it.
Yeah, I had a great time writing that. But so here's the thing, like the first draft of that book was, I won't say it was terrible, but it was tough. It was there was some tough going. Like I got kind of obsessed with the science. So I dove into the weeds a little too much and I didn't make it funny enough. And my editor at the time, a guy named Ben Greenberg, who's now at Penguin Random House, he just kind of said, like, he wrote me like a 3-page memo. It was like, just look, you know, have a little more fun with the concepts. Don't go quite into so much detail. And he said, like, make comparisons, right? Make analogies. So this is like that, you know, and that helps. And I kind of evolved in that. That's really where that style kind of first took shape. Where I, you know, there's a lot of science buried in that book, and I did a heck of a lot of research, but it's kind of, I kind of hit it in stories and, you know, made some jokes and, you know, and then some of it is quite funny, you know, in a way. I mean, honestly, it's aging, but you have to like have a sense of humor about it.
Yeah. Well, and I love how you make it personal. You're telling stories about you. And then I actually told my wife about your intro paragraph about the doctor that you mentioned. He lacquers himself up and he's about to pass out.
Yeah.
Like, maybe this was a bad idea. It's just so gripping. Like, just right off the bat, I was into the story.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's so cool.
So that goes back to what I was saying. Like, you have to get people's attention. Mm-hmm. And in the first draft of Spring Chicken, it was a much more kind of boring beginning. I think it was about like my grandfather or something like that. You know, kind of like, but I actually gave it to my friend, Christopher McDougall, who wrote Born to Run.
Oh, cool.
And he read the first like half of that first draft when I was struggling. And he said, look, no, your beginning is the guy with the varnish. You got to start with the varnish guy. And everybody, like my editor was like, no, don't start with the varnish guy. Or my agent at the time, not a good agent, said, don't start with the varnish guy. Everybody said, don't start with the varnish guy. But then Chris said, start with the varnish guy. So who am I going to listen to? I'm going to listen to the guy who sold like a million books, right?
Yeah.
And it worked. And honestly, like that was my instinct too, but I needed somebody to validate it and confirm it, because it was just such a funny story.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with aging even. It just introduces this guy who's a kook. But, you know, he was an 19th century scientist, and they just, a lot of times they did their first experiment on themselves. So he did the varnish thing. That didn't really, almost killed him. But then he did the thing where he mashed up, yeah, it's kind of gross, but like animal testicles and like injected himself. Tried that. So that was his like anti-aging concoction.
Yeah, and he got famous for doing that.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Just outlandish.
Yeah. 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 And now, of course, like lots of guys do testosterone supplements on a routine basis. It's almost like not even remarked on.
Yeah. Yeah. That's crazy. Okay, this will maybe be the hardest question of the day, but let's imagine you were a character in a novel. What is something that is quirky about your habits or maybe your writing habits, something that would make you stand out as memorable?
In terms of like things I do or things I write?
I would say things you do, but I would take either.
Boy, it's hard to step back and I mean I kind of get like obsessed with things and topics and but at the same time I have like I'm incredibly messy, right? So don't let this background fool you. This is our guest room. My office is like not. I'm working on doing some work up there on air conditioning and stuff. But I'm extremely messy and disorganized. And it's a product of, I don't know, a weird kind of ADD. But it also serves me in a way because I have sort of disparate materials around and, you know, books relating to all kinds of different topics, like within arm's reach, and notes about different things all scattered around my desk. It looks like a total disaster. And my partner doesn't even come up to my office anymore. She's just like, oh my God, I can't, because she's very organized.
That's so funny.
So yeah, it's a total mess. And I don't know, like maybe if I cleaned it up, I'd be more productive, or maybe not.
And the funny thing
is, I'm not going to take the chance. That's for sure.
So, I mean, your books obviously don't seem at all messy. They seem very just structured and so easy to follow. And like, it seems like the opposite of a mess as I read.
So yeah. But it's not easy to do that at all. Right. The key to it is like, you got to make it seem easy. Like the best writers I know, like it just seems so easy and you flows and you follow them. And each chapter kind of like springboards you into the next one. But that's like really hard to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, we tried to do it with Outlive as well. And that was, I mean, I can tell you like that was an ungodly mess at certain points of its evolution.
Well, man, let's jump into that. So,
okay.
We focus mostly on fiction. So having you on here as a nonfiction author is kind of an exception, but I'm saying that because I'm not sure a lot of our listeners will know about your book, even though, I mean, number one, New York Times bestseller, like just Outlive's just crushing it right now. But give us give us listeners an introduction to what Outlive is.
Yeah. So Outlive is a book about, really it's a book about, so on the cover, it says it's about the art and science of longevity, right? But it's really a book about medicine, rethinking medicine. Like that's like the big idea in the book. And so our take, Peter Attia and my take, is that medicine for too long has focused on treating kind of the aftermath of whatever, like an infection, a disease, a broken bone, whatever. And it's really pretty good at that. Like you can zap an infection, you can set a broken bone, you can repair something with surgery. It's quite amazing. But then if you look at the diseases that actually kill people, and those are heart disease, cancer, diabetes helps, Alzheimer's disease, kidney disease, things like that. So those aren't like acute problems that you can kind of fix, but we're still approaching them like we're going to cure cancer, right? So people are going to get cancer, then we're going to have a magic cure. But it kind of, we're kind of not having great results with that, because cancer is a process that begins, you know, a long time before you have symptoms. And so we have to come up with a better, it's a long-term condition. It's not like an acute disease. So we have to come up with a better way to approach it, which includes like focusing more on prevention, right? Focusing more on early detection, because now, you know, the big problem is by the time you find out you have it, you're kind of like in a bad situation, because it's late, and so you're coming in late. And so things like chemotherapy, that's like a late stage, last ditch effort, and it's terrible, right? And, you know, by the time you get to that stage, like you're fighting kind of an uphill battle. So let's reorient the timeline so that we can come in earlier and try and work on prevention detection. Because if you detect that cancer when it's just like a little tumor, you can cut it out. You can, surgery is still great. You can cut it out and then you're fine. And it hasn't gone anywhere. So changing the timeline, and, you know, maybe heart disease is a better example. You know, if you can kind of prevent arterial damage and blockage, that's much better than having to go in with like stents and all kinds of stuff like that. So that's our big idea. Mm. And so we unspool that through 496 pages. Of, you know, explaining how all that works, and then getting into some tactical stuff like how to approach nutrition, exercise, sleep, and especially emotional health. But so it sounds like, to your listeners, probably sounds like boring nonfiction, right? And the original draft of it, the original kind of version, the original outline kind of was kind of like a medical treatise and, you know, a policy argument. But, you know, in nonfiction, we have characters too, right? Mm. And I realized that my co-author, Peter Attia, is himself, he's an amazing character. He's kind of an open book. Like, he blogs a lot about his life and talks about his life very openly, but he kind of didn't want his story to be in the book. And so I had to be like, listen, like, in many ways, like, you are going to be like the stand-in for you're going to be guiding the reader through this material, through your experiences, right? So we start with him, like, as a young doctor, treating cancer patients and learning to be a cancer surgeon. And he's a really good cancer surgeon, but then, you know, he'll do an amazing pancreas operation on somebody and feel like, yes, like we got it, you know? And then the person will die like 2 years later or a year later. So he reached a crisis. He was like, what am I doing? Like, and who am I doing this for? Like, we got to find a better way to help people. And so he left medicine, which is sometimes good, like, to get perspective. Like, you can leave what you're doing and then you get a better view on it. Like, when you go on vacation, right? And you think about your life, you're like, huh, you know, I should really, you have some distance on it. Like, you know, I should change this or that. So yeah, he went into financial consulting and sort of came up with a new take on medicine that was more risk-based and more sort of forward-looking and less about cutting the tumor out and feeling like you did your job. If that makes sense.
Yeah. So you come on board with this project, and again, you said it's a treatise, and then you, cause you're a writer, you know how character works. How did you then, like, did you tell Peter, okay, Peter, you got to come up with these examples, or did you interview him and start pulling the examples yourself? Or like, how did you start getting all that personality and character into the manuscript?
Well, just as you get to know somebody, then, you know, he likes to tell stories and, you know, like, he told me some great stories about himself. So I would put them in, and he'd be like, take that out. And so there was a push and pull and bounce, but, you know, he's a super interesting guy, right? He's super smart. Came from his first generation Canadian family came from Egypt, you know, grew up kind of lower middle class, you know, grew up as a boxer. He thought he was going to be a boxer, and then somehow he ends up, like, he was crappy in school, and somehow ends up, you know, not only going to college, but then going to Stanford Medical School and getting, like, you know, the top kind of residencies and fellowships and, you know, pretty impressive on that level, but also this guy who, like, kind of takes things to, as his wife put it, the nth degree, right? So he, just as an example, this is something that's not in the book, but, like, he never learned to swim as a kid because he grew up in Toronto. I don't know why, but just didn't learn to swim. So he learned to swim, like, in medical school. And then, like, 2 years later, he's swimming from Catalina to Los Angeles, you know, 14 miles or whatever, across the ocean. So he just takes things to an extreme. And you know, he did a lot of his thinking evolved by trying things, like the varnish guy, trying things himself. Like, he was like 36 or something, and he was, like, overweight and didn't have good, you know, his blood work wasn't great. And he knew that, like, this is a bad sign for my future. And I just had this little kid, so I got to get my act together. Yeah. So in a sense, he became like a stand-in for the reader, right? So his journey to figuring out his own, how to fix his own health kind of became like the arc of the book.
So,
and he tried all these things like nutrition. He became an expert in nutrition, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, etc.
When you had a conversation with him and you found, like, another cool piece of the backstory that would fit in, would you have him go write that and then you'd finesse it, or would you write it? And then I guess you made it sound like he would say, take that back out. So it kind of sounds like you wrote these in.
Yeah. So we would do interviews and then have them transcribed. And, you know, I, you know, it was part, you know, you talked about voice. So it was partly like figuring out how he talks and kind of massaging that and making that a little more user-friendly. And then for the, you know, the scientific content, we relied on the whiteboard, the amazing technology known as the whiteboard. Mm. And so kind of outlined, he's big on frameworks and structure, right? And, like, you know, here are three ways to look at nutrition, blah, blah, blah. Or, you know, two things that matter to sleep. And so, and it, you know, turning that into prose was kind of my job.
Dang, that's cool.
And so we came up with a voice that was in between his voice and sort of my voice, but, you know, it had to sound like him, basically. So it's a weird out-of-body experience. It's almost like you have to, like, inhabit a fictional character, so he happens to be real, and how they think and how they speak. And so, yeah, it was interesting. I mean, I wasn't putting words in his mouth necessarily, but it was definitely interesting, like, writing with another person. And then we go back and forth, right? We have these brutal Google Docs that we go back and forth on, and, you know, he'd want to go deep on some into the what I call the alphabet soup, right? All the, like, names of the genes are all like APOE or like CLOTHO or you know, CETP. Like, it just becomes like this mind boggling mess of acronyms, and you just gotta be wait. You're losing people, and, like, you can't start off and hit people in the face with, like, a bunch of data and a bunch of numbers. Like, you have to ease into it and bring them with you. And then you can drop in the numbers and the data. But,
man, I just love the book. I think it's great. And
thank you.
I really feel like it could not have been the success that it is if it weren't so readable. And again, like you said, you made Peter Attia into a character that you could follow. And I actually kind of teared up when I read the part about there's the 14-year-old boy that gets killed in a T-bone car accident.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Won't quit. And like,
oh yeah.
Yeah. The pathos there. It's just like, oh, like I can feel this. And I think it's a book that you can feel. It's not just intellectual, but emotional.
Yeah. And you know, there were moments like that, that, you know, sometimes other readers would be like, oh, take that out. You know, it's not relevant. Like, no, like you have to feel like that this is a guy that like wants to save people. Right. There's a reason he got into medicine. Like, and, that was a sad moment. And then there's like comedy in that same phase of his life when he's like, I don't know if you read in the chapter on sleep, like there's a story about how, he was so tired as a resident. He's driving home. He falls asleep at the traffic light and he gets to the next traffic light and he falls asleep again. He's like, oh my God, I'm going to get out of the car. And so, oh, there's a nice park right here. I'm just going to go lie down on a bench or on the grass and take a little nap. Right. He wakes up 6 hours later and he's in like the worst park in Baltimore in his scrubs. Yeah. I mean, you just can't leave that out. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Man, and it's so pertinent too, because then the contrast about, I didn't care about sleep and now I'm telling you, this is about the most important thing you can do.
Exactly.
That's super cool.
Yeah.
Okay. So I listened to you and him talking on another podcast and you guys talked about how it took 6 years to bring this book to life. Why was it such a struggle? It almost got canceled in 2020. Tell us just a little about that journey of, I mean, it sounds kind of like an epic struggle and then boom, this huge success at the end.
Yeah. Originally, you know, I signed up, he'd approached me, he'd seen some magazine articles I'd done about longevity and a drug in particular called rapamycin, which I think is super interesting because it kind of like, this drug kind of like turns down sort of pro-aging pathways in your cells. It's pretty amazing stuff. They haven't quite worked out how to best give it to people yet, but it's like, oh, this is super cool. And some pharmaceutical companies were trying to develop it at the time. So he read this article and liked it. And he was looking for an author because, you know, he had written a kind of a treatise that had the content, but it didn't have the narrative. So anyway, he got to me and
did the rapamycin article have the kind of pathos and character that we've been talking about, or was that more on the scientific side where it was just really factual?
That was a Business Week piece. And it was really the story of this interesting and kind of, I don't know how to describe him, unique scientist who had discovered this drug in like basically a jar of dirt from this island in the Pacific called Easter Island. And it turned out there was like a bacteria in the soil that secreted this stuff it was like an antifungal. He was like, God, oh, this is an interesting chemical. A lot of these drugs and stuff start out as poisons, right? The living things secrete to try and kill other living things or try and protect themselves. So this is a antifungal that the bacteria made to protect themselves. He thought, cool, like this thing is really active and it's potent and it could be like athlete's foot spray or something. And it turned out to do a lot more. Like it's given to transplant patients to prevent organ rejection. Pretty cool stuff. And now it's got this like longevity. This guy died about 20 years ago, but it's got this like longevity potential. Anyway, so Peter found me. And I got to write this book, blah, blah, blah. I thought, oh, cool. This is going to be really easy because I already wrote a longevity book. So I know the landscape. So this will be super easy and I'll work on it for a year and bada bing. And didn't kind of work out that way. And, you know, because the conception of the book changed, the kind of makeup of the book changed, we had a pandemic in between. You know, nobody's buying a longevity book in the pandemic, right? So we just scrapped it. But I was like, this thing is really good. Like, there's some good stuff in here that nobody's talking about. And we're taking a whole new approach to medicine. We're like, we're not breaking new ground in nutrition, but we're kind of, you know, everybody fights about diet and like their diet's the best and blah, blah, blah. So we kind of cut through a lot of noise in terms of nutrition. We told some amazing stories about like the history of science and like how we got to this place where cancer is still the top killer along with heart disease, right? And they shouldn't be. You know, it's like 50 years since the war on cancer. Like, let's get going. You know, so there's some good, like, you know, good, like, almost like muckraking type journalism in there, honestly. Like, why haven't we figured out Alzheimer's disease? Why haven't we figured out how to prevent cardiovascular disease better? So there's a lot of great stuff in there. And so finally, you know, Peter's pretty well connected. So he calls me up and says, my friend Michael Ovitz wants to see the book. And Michael Ovitz is this Hollywood super agent dude. It's like, oh, your friend Michael Ovitz. Okay. We'll send him the book. So we send him the book and he calls back like 2 weeks later, like, he just kind of got it rolling again. And I was relieved because I'd worked a lot. I'd worked really hard. I worked harder on this thing than ever in my life. And, you know, as a writer, often you work on things that come to nothing, right? And, you know, sometimes it's part of the process, but I mean, I'm a freelance nonfiction writer, right? So I don't want to write something and have it sit in a drawer. I do have things sitting in the drawer, but like I want something to get out and be read. Like I like being read by people. So that goes back to the voice thing. Like I want a readable, entertaining voice, right? I want people to read something, be entertained, be informed, and talk about it. So that was my goal. Like, this has to be done in a readable way that people are going to be like, you got to read this. Or they keep reading. You know, it was long too, right? It was really long. It was even longer when Michael Ovitz read it. It was ridiculously long. So we cut out some, but I don't know. Every week Peter would send me some more stuff like, let's put this in. You know, it's part of like, His mind, he's very curious, and so am I. So, like, yeah, let's put it in.
You don't happen to know word counts. Like, what was the longest draft?
Oh, geez. And
about how long is it now?
The longest version, I think it got up to about 180,000. And I think the published version is like something like 130.
Okay.
I signed up to write a 75,000 word manuscript.
Dang, that's crazy. I'm so glad that you made it through all the rough stuff, because it's something worth reading for sure. That's so cool.
You know, there, you got to believe, right? Like, so if you've got something good, and I felt like we did always, and sometimes I was the only person, right? Like, we didn't have a publisher. Peter had lost interest in it at times. Like, he wanted to write a book, but so at moments I felt, yeah, but I always thought it would be end up being good. So I'm proud of it.
Yeah.
I'm really proud of it. And I think, you know, there's a last chapter that's a lot about Peter's sort of emotional health journey that he went through while we were writing the book, right? So that in a sense is the story, part of the story of like the ups and downs of writing the book. And part of it was, I was like, listen, Peter, like, everybody goes crazy when they write a book. Like, you're not the only person who like is like at the end of their rope in this process, right? It's hard to maintain your equilibrium sometimes. And you go through these periods of like, this thing sucks. Let's just delete it all. You know, let's just throw it all in the fire because it stinks. It's terrible. And then the next day you're like, oh, I'm glad I didn't do that. But, you know, I think I mentally, I was like, I quit many times. And I think he was like, I quit a few times too. And, you know, it was tumultuous, but, you know, as I said, like, I would say to him, like, you're not different from any other writer. You're just, this is normal to go through these kinds of feelings, especially like as publication approached, you know, you're all anxious and you can't fix it. Right. So we're like, is it good? We think it's good, right? It's good, right? No. Like, no, it's good. It's good. Yeah. It's nerve wracking. And it's nerve wracking to live with somebody like that. So, you know, my partner, Martha, many, many, many times had to like talk me down and, you know, and just be like, you'll get through this. You'll get through it.
Was she one of your beta readers? So she was like pretty up on the project as it went.
She's the. So yeah, she's not a writer. She's not a medical person. She's like a normal person. So she's a great target audience, a great sort of focus group of one. Like it's like, how does this sound? Does this make sense?
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Too, that Peter's struggle and the emotional challenge comes through in the book, like you said, but I find it interesting for you to say that, yeah, that was kind of me too. Like it was the same up and down and kind of treacherous waters, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, he worked really hard and still continues to on himself in all dimensions, including emotional dimension. And, you know, he became a much better collaborator, you know, as we rebooted it, especially like we kind of had a talk and, you know, he became a much better person, collaborator, and friend. Thanks to the work he did on himself. And so, yeah, so then it was fun. Actually, it was quite fun. You know, revising normally isn't that fun, right? Can be, but this was like quite fun to take this like kind of messy, shaggy beast and, you know, kind of hone it down and make it clearer and make it better. So
yeah.
Dang, that took a year. It was super fun. Wasn't always fun. It was mostly fun.
So let me ask a couple more questions about co-authoring, because I think that'll be a big, like an insightful takeaway. So to be honest, personally, as a writer, I love that it's solitary. Like I'm kind of an introvert.
Me too.
But yeah, I've too. Always thought that it would be a ton of fun to collaborate and to co-author something. So what was something that surprised you as you got into this co-authoring project? Maybe something you hadn't thought about before and you're like, whoa, I didn't realize it would be like this.
I knew nothing about co-authoring and I think I approached it thinking like, okay, I'm just going to be a ghostwriter, right? So I'm just going to take the content of what he's saying and put it in my own words, entirely my own words. And that didn't work, right? You know, because I'm probably more glib and probably more inclined to like make jokes. He's a little more serious. And he was at a different place in his life. So that didn't really work. So we had to like come to the middle and find this, like I said, this voice, this kind of happy medium that would kind of work for both of us. So that was one thing. It was interesting. As he read the audiobook, he would come up with, and this was a huge pain in the neck at the time, but like he started like doing line edits and they were good. They're really good. I was like, oh gee, I didn't think about that. That's a better word. So he kind of like became like a writer a little bit. Hmm. And he's a good writer. Like his blog is good.
Yeah.
You know, it's, which he writes on his own. So that was interesting. And yeah, the kind of the mind meld, aspect of it. But, you know, for like a non ghostwriting, it's not really ghostwriting, but co-authoring is huge now. Like I have a lot of journalist friends who essentially make their living co-authoring books with folks. Hmm. It's kind of the way publishing is going. And you know, I think 20 years ago, I might've like, you might've like looked down on it a little bit, but it was actually, it was interesting. It's not that way anymore. It's not looked down on. It's,
yeah,
it's respectable.
I'm actually surprised to hear you use the term ghostwrite. Was there a point where it was considered that your name wouldn't be on the cover?
Okay. No, it always, no. So one of us had written a New York Times bestselling book about longevity already, and that was me. Mm-hmm. So it was always going to be so we thought of it at first in our first meeting or first couple meetings. It was kind of like, okay, so this is going to kind of be like Freakonomics for health, mm-hmm. right? So Freakonomics is there's the economist, an economist can't write, right? And the journalist. And so you kind of come together and you kind of have a take on things and you kind of try to get people to rethink what they think they know about, in our case, health and medicine. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of how we approached it. Be like Freakonomics for health.
Yeah. Dang, that's sweet. well, and so again, our listeners are authors and aspiring writers. Do you have any words of warning or words of wisdom if someone's going to approach a co-authoring project?
You know, to a certain extent, you have to put your you know, you have to put your ego on the shelf a little bit, a lot. I would say, you know, pick your co-author, right? So it's got to be somebody you agree with, get along with, like on some level. You know, Peter and I became friends, but it took a while. I don't know. I know it's funny, like I've got a couple of fiction projects on my hard drive also. And that just seems incredibly difficult to pull off and create like a suspension of disbelief in people. So maybe you can tell me how to do that sometime.
That sounds great. I'm curious. Give me just briefly, like what kind of genre, what kind of fiction do you want to write?
So I like, I actually really like, I don't want to say history, but I like the past.
Okay.
And bringing the past to life is fun for me. And so living out west now, you know, there's some, I'm from the east, but there was a part of my family that was into mining out here a long time ago. And there was some gnarly stuff that happened that is very fictionalizable.
Dang. That sounds cool.
Yeah, but you know, that's on the back burner at the moment.
Yeah. Well, it just reminds me of I read some Louis L'Amour when I was a kid, and you know, kind of Western miner and miners and gold, and anyway. So when you say that, it makes me excited. It does sound interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, I mean, one thing I would say is that an ability to write is a very like transmutable skill, right? You can use it in many different ways, and you know, co-authoring happens to be a good way to put bread on the table at the moment. So if you could find ways to use that talent that you have to support yourself, in addition to using it to fulfill yourself as an artist, that's good.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's many, I think there's lots of different ways, forms it can take. Like I started out, I came out of college, I kind of, for a while there, I thought I was going to be a poet, right? Mm. I had all these poet friends and some of them are poets. And then I just wanted more people to read me, honestly, like maybe that was an ego thing, but like I want to be read by like lots of people. So that's what steered me into nonfiction.
Dang, cool. I'm glad you ended up here. So this is the second big writer question. The first was collaboration. The second, and we've kind of already touched on this, but in another podcast, you said that you worked on the literary side of Outlive, right? So what does the literary side include? And I mean, I know you guys both wrote it, but like, can you pull out kind of your half and say like, well, this is what I did. Like, what is the literary
side? I almost can't, you know, because especially as it went on, it kind of became, you know, so technically it was like my job to like get the words on the page and get the words on the Google Doc and kind of manage the manuscript. But you know, it's a two-way, that was very much of a two-way street. It's like, I don't want to say this, I want to say that. Mm-hmm. Or a big thing he did in 5 years, he changed his mind on a lot of stuff,
yeah.
Which I think is cool. Like for, you know, a lot of science people can embrace a dogma, you know, mm-hmm. especially if you're writing about like nutrition or whatever, like people are going to be very dogmatic, but he completely changed his mind on stuff. So I would have to rewrite entire sections, entire chapters. But yeah, no, I put the words on the page. And, you know, a lot of times they came from him. Sometimes they had to be rearranged. Sometimes I had to come up with a new way to say something. So sometimes it'd be like, here's how I'm thinking about cholesterol now. Like, come up with a way to say this. Like, okay. So I'd come up, you know.
Take
the data and come up with a story and metaphors and whatever. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I was going to ask. There are a lot of cool metaphors. The bathtub overflowing, George Foreman versus Muhammad Ali. Like, is that you?
That's all Peter. You? Yeah.
Oh,
no, okay. He's a boxer, right? So that analogy was, that was all him. So we use that to distinguish strategy from tactics, right?
Yeah.
So the strategy is like the framework of thought around how you're going to attack a problem, like trying to beat George Foreman, who completely is kicking everybody's ass in boxing. And Muhammad Ali is this older, kind of a little out of shape guy. And so you have to think, like, what's your strategy? How are you going to approach this problem? And then, so just to use the Ali example, he realized that Foreman had a bad temper and wasn't very smart about, like, conserving his energy. So Ali then came up with the tactics. I'm going to piss him off and then kind of hide and let him wear himself out trying to chase him around the ring. So that was the rope-a-dope, right? So he like lay against the ropes getting punched, but like it's Foreman who's using up all his energy. Hmm. Right. And then he's tired and then Ali can come up and beat him. Hmm. It's a fun story to tell. It's like the varnish guy, right? It's just it's a fun story to tell. It doesn't really have anything to do with longevity, but it's entertaining and serves the purpose of the book in a different way.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I think that how it illuminated the difference between strategy and tactics and why tactics matter. I thought it was great. Okay. So Peter mentioned that you work with a guy, Rodrigo, I forget his last name.
Corral. Yeah. Rodrigo Corral. Yeah.
For the book cover. And, like Peter kind of gave you a shout out, like, oh, this was a crucial connection. But it made me think that you kind of, I don't know if, do you have an affinity for graphic design or like, it just seemed like you made an important move with the cover. And tell me more about that. How did you have that connection? Why did you care?
So I do like, I'm pretty visual. I like art. I study a lot of art history. My sister is a graphic designer, actually, and she's a book designer. So I'm kind of attuned to that world. And, you know, it's hard to come up with a good cover for a book on longevity, right? Like, were you going to show like a skeleton or something? Like there's many ways it can go wrong. And we were kind of, our options were kind of these very sort of neutral, type driven type covers. And so I just asked my sister, who's the best person? Who's the best cover designer now? And so she likes this guy, Rodrigo Corral. Mm. And so we went to him and, you know, so the thing I would say to authors is a good cover can like take you a long way. And Spring Chicken had a great cover.
Oh,
too.
Yeah, I totally agree. I love that cover.
Yeah, that was Oliver Monday. He's a great designer. But yeah, so Rodrigo, we talked to him, sent him the manuscript. And this was a very, very, very short timeline. Like, they were screaming at us, like, this has to be done. Like, you know, we're way past all the deadlines. I'm sure he got paid a ton of money. But he came up with like 10 great options for covers. And the one we picked was good. And, you know, you can see it a mile away. Like, I was walking through I was walking through two airports and like,
oh, cool.
There's my book in the airport. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. You'd see it like right next to the Dunkin' Donuts, and the bookshop was right next to the Dunkin' Donuts. So there's Outlive and then there's Dunkin' right above it. But it pops, right? Basically. Mm-hmm. It's unique. It doesn't look like anything else out there. Yeah. Cover's important.
Mm. And so this is just a personal question, but the dotted lines on the egg on Spring Chicken, it almost looks like pants to me. Is that what it's supposed
to be? Yeah, so there's two schools of thought on that. I don't know if you could show the visual, but it's like a big egg and it's got some dotted lines on it. Uh-huh. And so I think they were supposed to be like for plastic surgery. Like if you go in and get like facelift, they'll do, I don't know this personally, but they'll do like little dotted lines. So that's the one school of thought. That's for the surgeon. The other, it sort of looked like tidy whitey underwear because of the way the lines were configured. So take your pick. And it's in the eye of the beholder. Yeah.
Yeah. I love it. Okay. So at the end of the book, you get your acknowledgement section and you thanked Martha McGraw, Bob Kaplan, and Stephen Dark. And I just feel like the acknowledgements are usually a story that never gets to be told. And I mean, just briefly, but tell us about these three people. And specifically, I'm curious about, you said Stephen Dark for All the Walks.
So
tell us about the acknowledgements.
So Martha's my partner and she helped me a lot. I wanted to be brief in my acknowledgements for some reason. And she's wonderful and she helped me get through the process. And she always believed that it would be successful. And that means a lot to me as a writer. Like you don't want somebody giving up on you, even though there were many, it was a long road. And, you know, there were times when it seemed like I might've wasted a couple of years. Mm. So I really owe her a lot for that. Bob Kaplan was Peter's chief of research. And honestly, like he did a lot of the heavy lifting as far as like mustering the studies that we needed to kind of support our points, finding the studies that made us change our mind on things, and just helping me sort of understand. I'm an English major, right? Mm-hmm. I don't have a medical degree. So helping me understand things like metabolism, Alzheimer's disease, and the different theories of Alzheimer's disease. So he's like this like octopus of like tentacles reaching out and pulling in all kinds of studies and experts and information and kind of digesting it. And so I would, you know, I spent, I think there was one Christmas when I went to his house. I spent about 10 days. We spent about 10 days together, just like going through reams and reams and reams of research for about 12 hours a day.
Wow.
And to come up with like the meat of, kind of the meat of the center of the book, the chapters on cancer, Alzheimer's, diabetes, heart disease, and centenarians. Yeah.
Sorry,
so he was the research guy. So he was amazing. And then Stephen Dark, he's just a friend of mine. He's was a journalist here in Salt Lake for the City Weekly. Just great guy, good friend and good sounding board for, you know, anything from complaints to, you know, inspirations.
Yeah. Dang, that's cool. I noticed that you use the term four horsemen about heart disease and Alzheimer's and cancer. But so I'd always assumed that was Peter Attia, but that phrase, is that you? Did you come up with that?
Oh, gee, I don't know. I feel like other people have
so that's like
have said that. Okay. Yeah, I think so. Huh. I might have said it in Spring Chicken even, but
no, you did. Like, sorry. That's what I meant to say. You said it in Spring Chicken, so I assumed that it was,
Yeah. Huh. Yeah, I mean, it's. I had probably heard it from somebody else, but the four horsemen of the aging apocalypse, right?
Yeah.
Heart disease, cancer, diabetes, and Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's and other neurodegenerative diseases. So yeah, the four horsemen are our enemies.
Yeah. To wrap it up, I just wanted to ask you some rapid fire questions, just a series of really quick. I don't have empirical data on this, but I know that some of my author heroes don't seem to be in the best physical health. and if let's say the only tip they're ever going to get is this podcast, what would you tell writers that they ought to be doing about their physical health?
So sleep as much as you need to. Don't shortchange your sleep. That would be number one. I went through like decades of my life when I'd be like working till like 2 a.m. trying to get by on like 5 hours of sleep. And you just write a lot better if you put it down and sleep and go do something physical, like go for a walk or go for a run if you can run. I like to go for bike rides. And so, yeah, get away from it and either sleep if you need to sleep or do some aerobic exercise, which gets like the neurons, you know, jumbles up the thoughts and they come out. You come out with a solution to whatever problem was bugging you. And sleep works the same way, right? You go to bed with a problem and often you wake up and you realize how to solve it.
Were there any habits that you changed having done all this research and writing on health and longevity?
Sleeping was one. And in terms of like eating, in terms of diet, like I did the continuous glucose monitor, which is like a patch you wear on your arm, and it tracks your glucose levels throughout the day. And I realized that like some things that I thought were healthy were really just jacking my glucose through the roof, you know? Yeah. So, you know, no more pancakes, right? And no more like vegetarian tacos, like those. So yeah. So keeping, you know, boring, but like important glucose levels, you want to keep them relatively steady and not have these big spikes going up and down all day long. And for your energy levels too, like if your glucose is dropping, you're not going to feel so good. And then you have to eat more sugar and pop it back up. And that's how most writers live, right? On this cycle. Yep. But
pizza and Coke.
Yeah. Pizza and Coke. Never drink Coke.
Okay. Let's see. What is your favorite game to either watch or to play?
To watch, or my favorite game? I like watching what the rest of the world calls football. So soccer.
Yeah.
I enjoy that. I find that enthralling and kind of relaxing at the same time. Now I like cycling. So I watch the Tour de France, and that's good. Like that's good background sometimes, because you know, the stages are so long and sometimes like not that much happens for long periods. So you can sit there and like either zone out or do email or whatever. So yeah, cycling is a game. I guess it's a sport.
Yeah. Not totally counts. That's great.
Okay. Okay.
What book or writing project are you working on now?
Oh, so I'm working on another sort of health related, book project. It's not completely, I mean, I'm contracted, but,
it's not quite ready to be
talked about, but it's an extension of something we talked about in Outlive to a certain extent, but did not explore fully. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. It's fun. I like writing about this health stuff. I think the human body is fascinating. I think there's so much we don't know about it and so much we believe about it that's wrong. Like even your doctor. Mm-hmm. I was talking to somebody, I heard this from a medical person, but you know, something like half of what is taught in medical school is probably going to be revised or rethought eventually. So we don't know as much as we think we do. And so that leaves a lot of room for, creative scientists and also sort of inquiry and curiosity about different topics.
Yeah.
It's fun.
What book are you going to read tonight?
Oh, you know, the next book I'm going to buy it's by Michael Finkel. It's about an art thief. He was just on a show called Radio West here. And of course, because I'm 56, I forgot the title. I'm going to Google the title. The Art Thief. It's about an art thief. It's called The Art Thief. And it's about this guy, this French guy, who stole hundreds of works of art from over 100 museums, mostly in Europe. But instead of like most art thieves who go sell them to like, you know, billionaires or whatever, he just kept them because he liked them. He loved them. He wanted to have them. So he was like a real esthete, but also like a crazy criminal. But he would, you know how they have like the plexiglass cases in the museum? He'd just go with a Swiss Army knife and like undo a couple screws and make off with these things. Like just
that's crazy.
So it seems like a crazy story.
Yeah, that's a good premise.
The Art Thief. Yeah, I want to read that next. Yeah.
Who's an author that you look up to?
Author that I look up to. So I think there's a guy named Craig Childs who lives here in the Southwest. I think he lives in Colorado. And he writes a lot about sort of desert ecosystems and ancient desert people and archaeology. And he knows, you know, the territory, like between where we are and like Mexico, like the back of his hand. And so he's always roaming around and he's someone for whom like roads don't exist, right? Or trails. He just like sets That's out cool. across the, like if you plopped him down in Moab or whatever and said, walk to Mexico, don't use a road, he could do it. And he'd survive. Like he knows where the water is. Like he's unbelievable. And he's an amazing writer, unbelievable, beautiful writer, incredible prose. I find it inspiring, you know, sometimes just to like listen to the audiobook.
Oh.
You know?
Does he read it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Dang, that's cool. I'll have to
check. Yeah, he's
that.
the real deal.
Hmm. Okay, last question. What is the one book that has had the greatest impact on your life?
Oh wow. Impact on my life. I think probably my favorite, I'm not going to say I lived my life according to this book, but I think Catch 22 is the best, the funniest, most absurd.
Yeah. Such a great,
you know,
book.
Social satire, incredibly well written. Yeah. You know, sort of absurdist worldview and
yeah, lots of fun.
Catch 22.
Yeah, cool. Okay, well, I will give you the last word. So I don't know if you have a request of our audience. I don't know if you have a tip for them. You've already given some.
I don't know. If they could teach me how to write fiction, that'd be great.
Okay, yeah. Another one is if there's a question that I should have asked you, but I didn't. Anyway, any parting thoughts as we close?
Yeah, I mean, one thing just lately that I've found that has helped me tremendously as a writer and a reader is, and people still look down on this and for some reason, but like the audiobook is amazing. And there's some incredible performances out there of like classic works that just bring them to life in a whole new way. And I think it's just for a writer, you know, I start my day with the dogs, walking the dogs, and I always put on some audiobook. Sometimes I get sucked into podcasts, but let's be honest, like the audiobook, like the prose is better, right? Because we're just talking extemp. And that is just a great way to just seed the mind with like well-structured prose that sounds beautiful. And, you know, I listen to, just Kenneth Branagh reading, Heart of Darkness, right? By Joseph Conrad, you know, you're not going to pick up freaking Heart of Darkness and read it, but like gives it this amazing performance. And he cuts out some of the, you know, words you're not supposed to say now, which is good. And it doesn't suffer. And it's great. It's like, holy mackerel, Conrad was an amazing writer. And just so immersing yourself in, not just in reading, but in the sounds, I think. I found that very, very helpful. And fiction stuff not related topically to anything I was doing.
Yeah, yeah. Dang, I love that tip. That's great.
Good writing, you know, expose yourself to good writing, but you can do it orally as well.
If people want to keep up with you online or, you know, follow you or whatever, where should they go?
I'm still on Twitter.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, Twitter's having a hard time, but yeah, at Bill Gifford. And, you know, if you want to see like my dogs or like flowers or mountains that I ski on, I'm on Instagram too. But yeah, Twitter is a good place to find me.
Okay. Excellent. And to our listeners, I'll put links to all this stuff that he's talking about in the show notes, including his Twitter handle. Bill, thank you so much. This was a real pleasure.
Yeah.
I absolutely loved the book that you and Peter created. I think it's a classic, and
thanks.
I really think everybody should read it. It's the book on health, and it really matters. But anyway, thank you
thanks,
so
Jay.
Much. And to our listeners, it's time to start writing.
So there you have it. That was our interview. I hope you enjoyed it. You've heard me. This is a weird quirk that I have, but I tend to start writing novels with the title. And this title popped into my head, Stealing Indiana Jones. And I was going to write about, this is where the people who made Indiana Jones got their ideas from. And then I kind of wanted to expand that into, this is how artists come up with their ideas. So this is going to be a story about inspiration. And as I started drafting this, finally, you know, I'd been thinking about it for years, but I finally started drafting it. And as I was drafting, it started to be a story about my brother who passed away. And this essay started to also be the story of us. It's kind of light and fun, and it's about being a kid in the 90s. And it's also kind of this heavy manuscript about dealing with the death of someone who's really close to you. So right now I'm just going to play you, which is what is essentially the back cover blurb from Stealing Indiana Jones.
In 1990, a 6-year-old boy stole something from his neighbors, a small book, the ultimate Indiana Jones treasure, a Grail diary. It promised everlasting life, but because it was stolen, the little boy didn't dare tell his older brother, his mentor, what he'd done. In 2020, 30 years later, that older brother passed away. Stealing Indiana Jones is the true story of these two boys and how they discover a monstrous secret. That George Lucas stole his ideas for both Star Wars and Indiana Jones. As they struggle to make sense of what this horrifying truth means for all of us fans, they find redemption along the way. Their story explores inspiration and how great stories come to life. It examines, without shying away, disillusionment and innocence doomed to die. Their story is a salute to the loss of childhood and to the loss of life. Stealing Indiana Jones is a journey through the 90s, a glimpse of boyhood and fandom, and it's filled with both heartbreak and heroism. Most importantly, it's a quest to uncover the secret behind all great stories. The secret of immortality.
I am very proud of this. It's a short piece. It's available on Audible now. And I got to narrate it. And that was a lot of fun. If you're interested in reading it, you can find it on Amazon. Or anybody who signs up for my newsletter, I send them a free copy of this ebook. And you can do that at theinformant.jwashburn.com, or just look down in the show notes of this podcast and you'll see a link to it.